Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Democrat Stephanie Hansen won the highly anticipated special election in the state Senate's 10th district. Political reporter James Dawson joins us to offer his insight into that result and its implications. Delaware State University President Harry Williams joined other leaders of historically black colleges and universities in Washington, D.C. this week to meet with President Trump.
The president said, and there is on record, that HBCUs will be a priority for my administration, and that was significant.
We talked with Harry Williams about President Trump's commitment to HBCUs. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also have the second part of our two-part History Matters focused on the Underground Railroad in Delaware. Hear more about this year's State Employee Art Showcase and talk to a UD professor with a direct connection to those Earth-like planets recently discovered by NASA. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The highly anticipated special election for the state Senate's 10th district seat is over. Democrat Stephanie Hansen won last Saturday, scoring a resounding victory over Republican John Marino and Libertarian Joseph Lazendorfer. Hansen drew 58% support, beating Marino by over 2,200 votes, and turnout was 35%, unheard of in a special election. Hansen's win in the race that drew national attention and over $1 million in fundraising money allows Democrats to maintain their nearly four decades hold on the state Senate with an 11-10 margin. And Democrats nationally are hailing Hansen's decisive victory as the first salvo in their battle against President Trump's agenda and Republicans' hold on the White House and Congress. Delaware Public Media political reporter James Dawson tracked this race from its start and joins us this week to break down what it all means. James, thanks for being with us.
Hey, good to be here, Tom.
Well, you have followed this race, and recalling how close Marino came to upending the former seat holder, now Lieutenant Governor Bethany Hall Long, a couple of years ago, how surprising is Hansen's victory size, the margin, even the Democrats?
I don't think it was that shocking that she won. The margin was a decent bit higher than a lot of people had thought. But the 2014 election that you mentioned between Hall Long and Marino was kind of an anomaly because her husband was caught stealing Republican campaign signs. But if you go back and look at November's election and even 2012, Democrats just rolled over the GOP. It really wasn't close.
The turnout, as we mentioned, was massive by special election standards. And in this state, turnout generally favors Democrats. But does that turnout and the Democrats' fundraising and use of big names like Joe Biden and Martin O'Malley to drive it entirely explain Hansen's victory in this race?
I think this was really the key. I mean, we're talking about 35% turnout, which on its face really isn't that great, right? You have a third of registered voters coming out.
The bar's pretty low.
Right. But compare that to turnout in the 2015 special election where we saw 10% of registered voters come out and even 7% a few years before that, and you'll see why it's so important. But I'd say the fundraising side was more important than getting big headliners to make noise while knocking on doors with the campaigns themselves. I mean, we're talking $1 million between the two sides here and their affiliated PACs, which is just astronomical for this race. It's going to be even higher once we get the final numbers, too. And Democrats just really didn't want to screw around on this one. They knew the Senate was on the line, and they tapped into frustration built up from President Donald Trump's first couple months in office.
We even saw TV ads from Stephanie Hansen, which in a state Senate race is also somewhat unheard of. Did it feel almost in some ways that she kind of pulled like from the Lisa Blunt Rochester congressional race playbook in terms of got a lot of money, got some TV, just going to kind of flood the field?
Yeah, I think that was definitely part of it. I mean, the TV ads came from at least what I saw, they came from the PAC side where they spent a ton of money on those mailers, you name it. I mean, robocalls, we saw it, the market pretty much saturated. And when I talked to a couple of voters who unfortunately didn't want to go on the record with me, but they were saying they were just fed up with how many pieces of mail they got, how many calls they got, how many people showed up on their doors just knocking, hey, are you going to vote for Stephanie? At least it caused some people to stay home, but obviously not enough to make a difference.
How about on the Republican side? How big a disappointment is this for Republicans to lose by such a margin in this race that they thought they might have a chance in?
Yeah, I think that's always a disappointment, but they knew it was going to be tough going into it. The GOP made gains in the House in 2014, couldn't break the supermajority that year or in November. They've had more success in the Senate. They knocked off two seats over the past two cycles, including the former Senate pro tem, obviously, in November. What we're going to need to keep an eye on is whether or not Republicans kept any of their money in reserve for next year to maybe try and win one of those statewide races that are going to be up or make more take more turf in the General Assembly. And if they blew their cash early, then we might not see much of a splash in 2018.
Does it also speak to the idea of that the candidate for Republicans is very important? I mean, John Marino had run before and he had some success, but you know, maybe he wasn't necessarily the right candidate right now, as opposed to some of these other Republicans who have been able to pull off surprising victories.
Well, and there was just so much confrontation and consternation in that campaign itself. I mean, they went through three campaign managers in a little less than 2 months, right? So that's definitely part of the problem. They tried to tap in. There was also a lot of push and pull between the more moderate, state GOP side versus more grassroots Tea Party faction here in Delaware. So he did try to tap in maybe subconsciously to that Trump feeling, right? Mm-hmm. Let's make Delaware first again.
Right.
even though he denied that there's any sort of connection between Donald Trump's campaign and his own campaign. But it just didn't seem to work out for him very well.
So maybe there are some lessons for Republicans to learn from this race that could and some of the other races that they've won as they start to look at what their strategy should be like. Let's talk a little bit more about the fallout from this race, and we'll start a little bit more locally. Democrats maintain control of the state Senate, as we mentioned, now 11-10 margin. What does that mean short-term and long-term for the General Assembly?
I think in the short term, not much is going to change. Democrats in the Senate are still going to need that Republican help if they want to pass any kind of tax or fee increase, if they even come up for a vote. And as for the long-term view, again, I think it's going to be watching how much effort the GOP puts into the 2018 election, mostly due to their cash flow or, like we just talked about, whether or not they have the bench deep enough to really field good candidates.
Is the most immediate impact that Sean Garvin is likely to be DNREC secretary sooner rather than later?
It certainly seems that way, at least if Governor John Carney can get all of the Democrats to vote for him. We'll see what happens there. I don't see any sort of hesitation, but it does seem likely here in a couple weeks.
And what are the expectations we have for Stephanie Hansen as a lawmaker? Do we have a sense of where she kind of fits in on the playing field and how she could impact the agenda going forward?
Well, the sense I've gotten from her is that she's going to be more to the left than many of her fellow Democrats in the Senate, but I don't think you could really classify her as a true progressive. She's a land use and environmental lawyer by trade who wants to be on the Natural Resources Committee, but we don't know yet what her committee assignments will be. During the campaign, much of her agenda was a little bit vague, but brownfields, redevelopment, and other economic issues are really at the top of her playbook. And that gels nicely with Governor Carney's plan to look at issues like that, but it's really too early to say specifically what we can expect from her.
Let's talk about it nationally. Democrats are pointing to this race, as we mentioned, as kind of a first referendum on President Trump and his agenda, and a sign that they're energized to regain their footing after taking some pretty big hits in November. Even Tuesday night after President Trump's speech before a joint session of Congress, new DNC chair Tom Perez was talking about this race on network newscasts as he was being interviewed. But this race in a blue state, in a district where registration favors a Democrat, is it really that much of a bellwether, do you think?
In terms of people rejecting Trump, it's probably not the best example you could use. I mean, this is still a majority Democrat district and a blue state, even though it leans a little bit more toward the center. What it really signals is the willingness from people across the country to volunteer for these local races. I mean, I was talking to a Democratic staffer a few days ago who told me he saw people drive from as far away as Ohio and Indiana just to knock on doors for Stephanie Hansen. So you hear stories like that in presidential campaigns, but that's an incredible amount of effort for a state Senate seat. And you couple that with the vast amounts of money that poured into the campaign, and it shows that Democrats can be serious about focusing on these smaller races. The key question is going to be whether or not the party can actually sustain that kind of enthusiasm and focus into the 2018 cycle.
And one other thing, kind of going back to what you alluded to before, there were some people who kind of were getting a little tired of it. Is there that danger in this state where, again, you know, there still seems to be a desire for that retail politic, that we don't want that many outsiders and that much outside money? Is there a chance that it hits a tipping point where it starts to kind of maybe backfire a little bit?
It really depends on the state. I mean, like you said, People in Delaware generally like to meet their candidates face to face. I don't think it's really going to be that much of a danger since Delaware is one of six states entirely controlled by Democrats. It's small enough where anyone who's running for office can go and meet their constituents in a pretty easy way. So I don't think the oversaturation is going to be any kind of a tactic coming up from the Delaware Democratic Party, but I think you might see it more on a nationwide scale.
Fair enough. Anything else you take away from this race and where we go from here?
I think a lot of Democrats have been fairly apprehensive about the huge amount of money used by Hansen's allied PAC in this race, and Republicans have called them out for it. It obviously didn't matter much to voters in the ballot box, but they say they've got to play by the rules that govern everyone. And ever since the Citizens United Supreme Court case allowed this kind of dark money spending, I mean, even campaign finance reformers are starting to adopt that playbook out of fear that they'll lose if they don't choose to do so.
We're also going to start seeing some real movement in the General Assembly now that this race is in the books?
That too. I mean, like you and I have talked about, some bills have been held back from people who generally don't actually necessarily care what kind of fallout comes from introducing legislation. So we're finally going to get kickstarted. We've had the first round of budget hearings. Governor Carney is expected to introduce his proposed budget here more toward the end of March after the latest state revenue forecast. So it's going to be a pretty easy ramp up once the legislative session starts March 14th.
Fair enough. James Dawson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And remember, you can follow all of James Dawson's coverage of Delaware politics anytime at DelawarePublic.org. And next up on The Green, we hear from Delaware State University President Harry Williams about meeting President Donald Trump and the Trump administration's plans to work with historically black colleges and universities. Stay with us. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Delaware State University President Harry Williams joined President Trump in the Oval Office this week for the signing of an executive order boosting support for historically black colleges and universities. Williams was joined by other HBCU leaders who were in Washington, D.C., to meet with lawmakers and high-level cabinet members like Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos. Delaware Public Media's James Morrison caught up with President Williams after his visit to the nation's capital to find out what he feels was accomplished.
I watched the signing, and you were standing behind the president in the Oval Office when he signed the executive order on HBCUs yesterday.
Yeah.
What was it like, you know, standing there behind the president in that moment?
I tell you, it was very interesting, and you know how you go to a place and you're just wondering what in the world is going on, and you walk in there and you kind of feel the significance of the moment, and by being there, it just highlighted for me the importance of our institutions, more specifically all of the HBCU universities in this country, and to have the President of the United States to acknowledge that very publicly and very clearly, it was a very good feeling.
And you were at the White House this week. It was for a listening session. Did you actually get to talk to the president to get a moment to tell him your ideas?
Actually, no, we did not. When we went and talked to the president, it was the purpose of that gathering in the White House was for the listening tour, dealt with the members of his staff and also the vice president. We had a very good conversation with the vice president. We had a very good conversation with members of Congress. The other key person in this that we had an opportunity to have a dialogue with, and I actually had a conversation with, is the Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos. She attended the listening session, and she was the keynote speaker for the luncheon that we had, and she was actually sitting at my table, and we had an opportunity to engage and talking about, you know, things related to higher education and the importance of that. Another significant moment was that the chair of the Education Committee, Congresswoman Virginia Fox, was there and gave remarks. And these are key individuals now that are responsible for legislation that can impact higher education issues.
And you got to speak with, as you said, Betsy DeVos and other lawmakers. You're the president of Delaware State University. What was one of the main issues that you were telling all of these important lawmakers and policymakers when you were in Washington? What was some of the top issues?
Well, the main issue that we put on the table, and we articulated this very clearly with those individuals, was the need for infrastructure funds to support all HBCUs. And we actually put a price tag out there. We wanted them to know that we felt if the Congress would allocate $25 billion to support HBCUs, that it would be a significant impact in the sustainability of these institutions. We also asked if the Congress, in their appropriation of the federal Pell Grant program, which is a program that is designed to help needy students and students who have financial challenges, and to create that program that would be year-round, meaning that they could also use those dollars for summer school. And we got some positive feedback associated with that. And we wanted to be clear that it was important to protect the resources that we currently have. We know that the president introduced a very ambitious bill as relates to some of his priorities, i.e. building the wall. We know that process is going to cost a lot of money if we go through that process. Also, i.e. Supporting the military. And we wanted to be heard that this was a top priority as well, supporting schools like Delaware State. And the president said, and there is on record, that HBCUs will be a priority for my administration, and that was significant.
And in regards to this executive order, you were saying that this was a victory in a sense because it did bring this initiative from the Department of Education. Now this is under purview of the White House. Is this more of a symbolic order, or are there going to be real results where the rubber hits the road? Students, universities, HBCUs will be able to feel the impacts of this?
Absolutely. It's not symbolic. It will be a real meaningful move because we will have a real person that will be affiliated with it. We also asked, as it relates to the structure of the committee, and appoint an advisory board, members that would have influence that could support this executive director. And the code concept for the White House initiative originated out of the Carter administration in 1976. Jimmy Carter created this position. And the whole purpose of creating the position was for HBCUs to have an advocate to go and work with the 30-some-odd federal agencies and will be that person that would go in and advocate for resources, grants, federal dollars to support schools like Delaware State University. He felt, President Carter felt, that there was a need for it, and what we're saying, that there is a major need, but we would like that position to have a higher status because when you're in that role and you say you're coming from the White House, that adds something different to it. It gets your attention. So, and we want to make sure that we are receiving resources from NIH at a significant level that is fair. And NIH is National Institute of Health, NASA, NSI, National Science Foundation, NSF. Those are major federal agencies with major grants that they award to colleges and universities. And we, HBCUs, have outstanding scholars and scientists working on our campus, and one of the challenges have always been capacity and supporting and going after those grants. So those are the things that this position would do, and we can see results associated with that.
So speaking with all of these leaders, being able to meet the president, even if you weren't able to speak with him, coming back from this trip, how do you feel leaving Washington, D.C. yesterday? Are you hopeful?
Well, I'm cautiously optimistic. And what I mean by that, we did get a chance to speak. When I say we, I'm talking about the group. So we had a conversation with the president, and he reiterated his commitment. And actually, he did it twice in the Oval Office. And that was major. And that's a major step in the right direction. So we also met with key members of his inner circle, which again reiterated the president's support. We met with the chief of staff, and he was very clear on the president's support for HBCU. So those voices were very clear and positive, and that's why I say I'm cautiously optimistic, because we still have to go through the budget process. We still have to go through a process of the budget negotiation, because the president got to introduce his budget, but as you know, Congress is the one that will make that final decision with that in terms of appropriation, and we want to continue to have our voice at the table. So that's why it was significant for us not only to meet with the president, but to meet with the members of Congress that would be in the position to make those decisions, and we were able to do that, and it was done in a way, in a spirit of openness, in a spirit of wanting to hear, and that is significant. And to have that coming from the Republicans who are in charge of the House and the Senate, that is major for our universities.
President Williams, thanks so much for speaking with me today about this.
Well, thank you, and I look forward to listening to it on the radio.
Thanks to Delaware State University President Harry Williams for taking some time to speak with James Morrison this week following his trip to Washington, D.C. And stay with us. There is more to come on The Green, including our latest arts playlist, which focuses on this year's Delaware State Employee Art Exhibition. But first, the latest news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. State employees make Delaware run, and the jobs these men and women do run the gamut. But now we can also add artists to that list. In our latest arts playlist, Delaware Division of the Arts Deputy Director Kristen Pleasanton takes our own Mark Earhart on a tour of the State Employee Art Exhibition. The exhibition is open to state employees and their families, and this year features more than 200 works at the Art Center and Gallery on Delaware State University's campus.
So we have basically wall-to-wall artwork, and nothing is the same, and I can't see a discernible pattern. Describe to us, for people who obviously can't see this right now, what are we looking at?
We are looking at a full range of artistic media styles, ages, artwork produced by children. We have a category for youth that's under 12. We have teen, which is 13 to 18. We have amateur adults, intermediate adults, and professional adults. And this show is open to all state employees and their family members, so they were allowed to create anything they wanted, to bring in either a drawing, a photograph, a sculpture, something out of fabric or metal. Whatever they wanted to submit.
And when you say whatever, you do mean whatever. I mean, a variation of a mandolin-type instrument. I see a gourd that has been carved out. There's a butterfly carved out of a gourd. I see what looks like an oil painting of Elena Deladon, which is really good, which is right behind you right now, and what looks like some self-portraits, even a sweater. So this is amazing. And these are all either state employees or the family of state employees.
Correct. And the variety is something that is the most exciting, I think. When people come in to see the show, they're going to be amazed at the subject matter, of the size of things, the quality. So we show just a little bit of everything.
And these aren't all people who are involved with the DDOA or with arts organizations throughout the state. Some of these are Sunday painters, right?
Correct. People that are doing stuff in their spare time. And their children. And so this really allows everyone to have the chance to be in an art show, to compete for prizes. We give away over $3,200 in prize money. And so it's just a wonderful opportunity to see your work in a professional gallery. The DSU Gallery has been a great partner in helping us with this show and providing the space for us. And we're really happy to be here.
And we are quite literally surrounded by all of it. I'm just turning my head 180 degrees. If I was an owl and I could swivel 360 degrees, I don't know if I could even see it all. Let's talk about exactly how many pieces are in here.
We have 220 different pieces. We hung them all and placed them all throughout the gallery so that there'd be a variety. You'll see a wall and it might have a child's work, intermediate, teen, professional. It might have photography and painting and drawing. So we just try to mix up the show so that people are getting a view of different things and maybe even do some harmonious things like related colors on a wall or subject matter. But it's really fun just to see and explore the show and see what you see and what you like.
And I would like to go take a look at some of your favorite pieces.
Sure. So I'm going to go with this little cluster right here because I like how this. There are so many pieces in the show that I really like, but as I look at them, sometimes a few stand out. And the first one that really stands out to me is this painting that's sort of in a stylized folk art manner almost. It's called She Wanted More for Her Daughters by Anthony Burton. And it's a scene of a cotton field and you've got these figures working in the cotton field and sort of another figure that might be a little more menacing could be harkening back to slave times, but it's just a really personal, I think, story, and it really says a lot, I think, when you look at the painting and you read the title and you really feel what this story could be about. So I think the artist did a great job of portraying it in these bright colors and these brush strokes, these really evident brush strokes. It really is an interesting piece. And then above it, we have this cool sort of floral beadwork piece that is in an antique frame. And it's got these blues and kind of turquoise, greenish colors that play well against the folk painting, I think. I think it's a beautiful piece. And then next to that piece, we have a realistic pastel drawing of a blue crab, which is just another great Delaware kind of scene. And it also relates in color to the other two. So I think it's just a really fun grouping that we have on the wall. And it's kind of evident of different the different styles and different personalities of the artists that are in the show.
And I say you're right on that. They look so different, but they feel like they're almost connected in some strange way. Not by medium, but they just look so comfortable together. In the bottom painting, the almost folksy painting with the limbs that are a little bit stretched out, and it's not realistic, it's more stylized, mm-hmm. almost like it reminds me of Thomas Hart Benton.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But it's taking on almost a heartbreaking scene of what looks to be two slaves in a cotton field holding a baby with maybe a slave master or slave boss behind them doing them harm.
Mm-hmm.
And then above that you have something that is so beautiful and odd. It's almost a floral beadwork that's beset in that antique frame, but the frame comes out, and it looks like you're putting my fingers up here. It comes out maybe 6 or 7 inches. And then next to it, you have that almost realistic painting of a blue crab, but they use what almost looks like driftwood in the framework. And it's beautiful, but I couldn't think of three more pieces that are so different yet look so great together.
Yeah, I agree. And you'll find little snippets and little groupings throughout the show, too, that you're like, wow, I never would have maybe put those together. But when I see them together, it just makes the show that much more interesting.
Thanks to our Mark Earhart and DDOA's Kristen Pleasanton for their time this week in Arts Playlist. The Delaware State Employee Arts Show is on display at the Arts Center and Gallery at Delaware State University in Dover through March 13th. And stay with us. We'll have the second part of our two-part History Matters on Delaware and the Underground Railroad coming up. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. In part two of our History Matters on Delaware and the Underground Railroad, we turn to fugitive narratives, pamphlets published before, during, and after the Civil War by runaway slaves or abolitionists helping them. The narratives provide firsthand accounts of what life was like for those fugitives while enslaved, during their journey to freedom, and even after they achieved freedom. Many of these narratives were destroyed after passage of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, but some still exist, including those put together by a slave born in Delaware, Solomon Bailey. Snippets of Bailey's story appeared in a 2008 booklet written by First State historian Peter Dalio. Delaware Public Media's Megan Pauley tells us more about that story and the importance of fugitive narratives in this History Matters.
The most interesting thing to me as a researcher is to hear people's stories about what life was like and how they managed to escape enslavement and what it took.
That's Robin Krawitz, president of the Underground Railroad Coalition of Delaware. She says fugitive narratives have played an important role in preserving the stories of slavery, escape, and beyond.
Sometimes they would sit down with local abolitionists where they ended up, and they would go ahead and write it down for them, because a lot of these people were illiterate. And what the purpose of them was to, number one, highlight how awful slavery was, because that's, of course, as an abolitionist, that's the first thing you want people to know. And number two, it is about helping to raise money for these people, for the cause, and that's what these stories help to do.
Solomon Bailey authored his own fugitive narrative in 1825 after he had already escaped to freedom. His narrative came in the form of a 40-some page booklet, a common format for those stories.
Why the ones that survive, luck of the draw.
That's Peter Dalio, a researcher for the Delaware Historical Society's Center for African American Heritage. Bailey was born into slavery in Kent County, Delaware in the 1770s. After his slave owner, originally from Virginia, dies, Bailey and his family are moved to Virginia.
That was all legal to do, but then the owner sold the slaves out of state in Virginia, which was illegal.
Bailey was sold to a family living close to Richmond and was separated from his family members. But on his way there, he makes his escape.
Solomon slips out of the carriage, the wagon, and hides.
Solomon's escape journey doesn't stop there.
Solomon Bailey's story is just amazing to me because of the many modes that he chose to escape.
That's Debbie Martin with the Underground Railroad Coalition. She also worked with Dalio to publish sections of fugitive narratives from Delaware.
Solomon Bailey went from Richmond in a boat with another person down the James River to the Chesapeake and up the peninsula, and mentioned a couple of places, Nandu and Hunting Creek, and we can actually put them on a map in the Virginia part of the peninsula. How he got through Maryland, we have no idea. And then he ended up at a place called Anderson's Crossroads.
Dalio says Bailey also documented other key events, like making his way back to Virginia to bring his mother to freedom and efforts to purchase his son Spence's freedom at an auction.
And the tension in that is tremendous. Because he's got people bidding against him, against Solomon for Spence, and it looks like Solomon's going to lose him. But fortunately, someone in the crowd helps Solomon.
Eventually, however, Solomon's slave owner catches up with him.
And he says, Solomon, you know, you're going to have to pay me, or you're going to have to do something, because I own you. And Solomon says, that's not fair. And he says, I'm going to start a lawsuit against you.
They ultimately strike an agreement, with Solomon working for a while longer to pay for his freedom. Then, just a few years after Bailey's first fugitive narrative booklet is published, he and his wife Tamar move to Africa.
Which is a whole other story, but it's part of his narrative, where he was inspired by a merchant in New England. Captain Paul Cuffee.
Cuffee wanted to get Liberians back to Africa to help settle Sierra Leone.
The Back to Africa movement was not well received in many parts of Delaware by whites or by blacks.
Bailey later published a second, much shorter narrative in 1833 describing his life in Liberia.
It's more of a come and visit. These are the things that are you can grow, and these are the things you can eat, and these are the things you can't eat.
According to Dalio, Bailey intended to train Liberians to become Christian capitalists.
But it's also very useful to find out that the narratives in general, but to find out their selfhood, how they're actually surviving this, what made them as people.
Bailey's spirituality played an important role throughout his life, and he eventually became a Methodist preacher in Liberia. His spirituality shows up in letters he sent to his friend Joseph Bringhurst in Wilmington. In one of those preserved letters, Bailey says,
"Did I say I was joyful? Yes. To think of that good hand of providence that appeared unto me in the wilderness when I was sent away to the back country to be sold from my wife and my firstborn son."
Bringhurst was an abolitionist and friend of Thomas Garrett, and also involved in the American Colonization Society, a Quaker society focused on repatriation to Africa. The correspondence between Bailey and Bringhurst also included business of the day, lists of items Bailey would like to purchase, along with inventories of goods sent to Liberia. They also detail agricultural struggles, with Bailey talking about how local crops were not as easily shipped like wheat or corn in America. And at times, the letters indicate life in Africa wasn't easy for Bailey.
"It seems like the time has come to ask who is on Lord's side, seeing the people are so much one against another."
Still, Bailey and his wife remained in Africa until their death. Bailey's 1825 fugitive narrative pamphlet and select letters sent to Bringhurst from Africa are preserved in University of Delaware's special collections and currently on display at UD's Morris Library. For Delaware Public Media, I'm Megan Pauley.
Thanks, Megan. And a special thanks to the University of Delaware's Special Collections Department, Mount Pleasant High School teacher Boniface Naba, and the Delaware Historical Society for their help with this piece. Delaware's homage to the Underground Railroad continues this month with events March 10th and 11th, marking Harriet Tubman Day on the 10th and the opening of Maryland's Harriet Tubman Visitor Center. And next up on the Green, Enlighten Me, and a conversation with a UD professor with a special connection to that cluster of Earth-like planets NASA told us last week researchers had recently found. This is Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. NASA announced last week that researchers had uncovered seven Earth-sized planets orbiting a red dwarf star. These planets could potentially sustain life because of their proximity to this star that's not nearly as hot as our own sun. It's a star we've known about for nearly two decades and is certainly familiar to University of Delaware physics and astronomy professor John Gieses, who discovered the star 18 years ago. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media science reporter Katie Pikus talks to Gieses about the star and his reaction to these seven planets found surrounding it.
Dr. Gieses, this star that you discovered in 1999, that's a red dwarf star, correct?
That's right.
So what sort of properties does it have?
This is basically about the smallest type of star that can exist. It's about physically the size of Jupiter, but it's probably 100 times the mass of Jupiter. So everything is packed in very densely. And so it has nuclear fusion in the core, just like the sun does. But because it's so small, it's very dim and doesn't give off very much light.
And when you discovered the star, did you see or suspect the planets orbiting it?
No, not at all. We did always say that it was important to find red dwarfs because someday someone might find planets around them, but we had no idea that this particular star was special or really that, you know, that it would be feasible to find planets the way that the TRAPPIST group did.
So when NASA made the announcement uncovering seven Earth-sized planets orbiting that star, what was your reaction?
I was very excited and happy, I mean, and kind of astonished, right? There were already, you know, had been an announcement that it had three planets, but for there to be seven is really quite amazing. The same group had previously announced that there were signs of a few planets, and then NASA went out and discovered there weren't three, there were actually seven.
So ever since the announcement was made, what has gone through your mind as far as what these planets could be capable of?
I think the exciting thing is that because these planets are transiting, we have a lot of hope that with the James Webb Space Telescope that's coming up, we'll be able to learn whether these planets really do have atmospheres and whether they are, you know, Earth-like, you know, in which case they really would be habitable, or if they're more like Venus, which is, you know, a hellish, you know, awful place, or Mars, which is cold and frozen and has hardly an atmosphere at all. And, of course, we really know next to nothing about the planets. We know that they're about the size of Earth and that they must be rocky, but we don't know very much about what conditions are like on them. And so I think that it's going to be a very big effort in the upcoming years for people to try to figure out what these planets are really like.
And what do you think of the possibility that these planets could sustain life?
Well, I'll say that it is a real possibility. On the other hand, I would, if you, you know, had gun to my head, I would bet against it. You know, there's too much we don't know about what's the effect of being so close to a red dwarf star. The good news is these planets are close enough that they're getting enough light to be the right warmth and temperature for having, you know, liquid water and oceans and lakes and ponds and things like that. But that doesn't mean they actually do. There are a lot of reasons you could dream up for why everything might go wrong on the planet, and that even though it's the right size, it won't, you know, actually be livable. We're just going to have to see, but it's exciting to find out that, you know, planets like this, you know, really do exist and they're nearby and we can study them further, and we'll find out whether these planets really do look like they at least have an atmosphere, whether they have oceans. You know, eventually information like that can be learned.
And ever since NASA made the announcement, are you going to continue research on the star now, or has that been something that you've already been continuing over the last few years?
Yes. This star is being studied right now with the Kepler Space Telescope in what's called its K2 mission. And so I had already been planning to look at the star, as I must say many other astronomers are. Everyone from the public gets to use the data equally. But so my graduate student and I are already making plans for what we can do with that data to measure about the properties of the star.
And what is the name of the star?
The original name was 2-mass J2306-2928 minus 05-02-285, which tells astronomers precisely where in the sky it's located, you know, with a unique designation, and that it was discovered with the 2-mass survey. But, of course, nobody likes names like that, even astronomers. And now that it was the first set of planets discovered with what was called the TRAPPIST survey, everyone calls the star TRAPPIST-1, and I think that's the name that's going to stick for the future.
And I believe you just mentioned it's being studied right now with the Kepler Space Telescope. Was this the technology that you used in the 1990s?
No, the technology we used in the 1990s was that there were two ground-based telescopes that were built and funded by NASA and the National Science Foundation, one in Arizona and one in Chile. They were equipped with the latest in infrared cameras, so this was the first time this was practical, and we took pictures of the entire sky. And that's how we were able to discover nearby stars that hadn't been seen before, because if you knew where to point, it would be easy to study the star, but of course, if you don't know about the star yet, you don't know where it's located. So the idea was that we were mapping out the solar neighborhood and finding where the nearby stars are with that technology. And so that was not a telescope in space. It had originally been proposed to be in space, apparently, in the 1980s, but someone realized it was feasible to do it from Arizona for one-tenth the cost, and so that's what they did.
Oh, so it was really like mapping out the solar neighborhood, as you said.
Yeah, so that was what we did, right? So we produced, you know, a catalog that lists, you know, 500 million stars, something like that, you know, and all of their locations on the sky. That's why we need so many digits to describe the name of each object. But then I went ahead and I found that this particular star, the 500 million, is actually extremely close to us and is a dim red dwarf, you know, not an ordinary star on the other side of the galaxy like most of them are. So we identified that this star was special and was a close neighbor to the sun. And that was why it was interesting to go then look for planets when this other group, you know, led by a group of Belgian astronomers, found the planets.
How do you think that the discovery of these seven planets orbiting this star maybe paved the way for future discoveries?
Yeah, I think that the discovery that rocky planets, you know, exist around this star, and not just, you know, one or two, but seven, sort of hints to us that there must be many, many, many planets around red dwarf stars. And so there's a lot of excitement in the astronomical community about looking now for planets around red dwarfs. You know, 10 years ago when they were designing the original Kepler mission, people mostly thought about planets around stars like the Sun. But these smaller, dimmer stars turn out to be really quite wonderful in terms of having large numbers of rocky planets around them, you know, as this discovery indicates.
I think that's all of my questions, but is there anything else that you would like to add?
No, I think that's it. I mean, it's very exciting. Everyone is you know, as thrilled, the astronomers are as thrilled about this as the general public is. That's what I would say.
Did you watch NASA's conference the other day?
I wasn't able to watch it, but I read all the materials and looked at the, you know, the pictures and stuff that they had. They were pretty spectacular.
But did you know that this discovery was even, you know, on its way as a part of this community, or were you equally shocked with the announcement?
I did not officially know, but news sort of leaked on Twitter the day before because I guess a newspaper somewhere had posted it early. I had actually seen it a day early because someone in England, you know, had put it was going around the internet a little bit. But I had no official knowledge of it at all, no. It is fun because, you know, you do these things and sometimes, you know, you're like, well, it's just another star or whatever, you know. But for them to, you know, turn out to be special in some way, you know, really makes you feel like you contributed, right, to the march of progress.
Thanks to our Katie Pikus and UD Physics and Astronomy Professor John Gieses for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. These stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website and on iTunes. We'd also like to hear from you. Send us your feedback and story ideas using our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Delaware Public Media's Mark Earhart, James Dawson, James Morrison, Megan Pauly, and Katie Pikus, as well as our president and station manager, Casey Houts. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thank you for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.